everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, and as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows. Hello and welcome to the Katie Helper Show. It is so great to be back. We've been away for a bit working on this documentary, and we are so excited to be back. I mean, we had a great time working on this documentary. We'll tell you more about it. As people probably know, it is about Holocaust survivors who are speaking out against the genocide in Gaza. And we met amazing people and did really great interviews. And we are so excited to share that stuff with you. But today we have an amazing show, and I'm so excited. And the timing, we have some terrible news, but we have a perfect guest to talk about it. Before I bring on the guest and I share his bio with you, of course, please do like the stream. Just give it a thumbs up. Also, make sure you subscribe to this channel if you don't already. We are almost at 250,000. And the reason we ask people to subscribe is because it just helps spread the word about the show and the important interviews that we do. Also, please, if you can, become a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. Again, that's patreon.com/thekatiehelpershow. If you can afford $5 a month, you get extra content, early releases. And if you can't afford that, you can still help make the show happen at a $1 a month level. So that's $12 a year. But of course, we really encourage people to do $5 a month if they can afford it. If you're more of a podcast person, you can listen to this as a podcast. And if you do that, please rate and review us. Okay, so I'm going to bring on our first guest. And again, as I said, this couldn't be better timing for terrible news. Josh Paul resigned from the State Department in October 2023 due to his disagreement with the Biden administration's decision to rush lethal military assistance to Israel in the context of its war on Gaza. He had previously spent over 11 years working as a director in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs, which is responsible for U.S. defense diplomacy, security assistance, and arms transfers. He previously worked on security sector reform in both Iraq and the West Bank, with additional roles in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, U.S. Army Staff, and as a military legislative assistant for a member of the U.S. House Armed Services Committee. Josh grew up between London and New York, and he is also a non-resident fellow at the organization Democracy for the Arab World Now, DAWN, and a recipient of the 2023 Callaway Award for Civic Courage. So welcome, Josh.
Thank you so much, Katie. It's great to be with you.
Yes, thank you so much for joining. And I'm so honored to be talking to you. You're extremely brave. You were one of the first people to resign over what the Biden administration is doing. And we have this breaking news, very disturbing breaking news, which is that the U.S. just authorized its biggest package of weapons to Israel since October 7th. So can you tell us about this package, Josh, and what your thoughts are on it?
Sure. So this is a set of notifications to Congress, which is the required process here, of arms sales totaling over $20 billion. They include 50 new F-15 fighter jets, as well as tens of thousands of rounds of tank ammunition, mortar ammunition. They also involve vehicles for the Israeli Defense Forces, for the ground forces, and a small number of air-to-air interceptor missiles. You know, I think coming at this time, where we have seen so much devastation and, frankly, so many violations of international law in the context of Israel's operations in Gaza, it's just, you know, really sickening and shameful to see our government moving forward with these sorts of sales, with these sorts of authorizations. And you add to that as well the context of this, you know, escalation that is going on in the region, the risk of war in Lebanon. You know, I think that there's just a lot to pause here and sort through, and really a dark day for American foreign policy.
And what are your recommendations? Because I know at DAWN that you urged some particular action.
So the actual truth is that with the administration moving these sales forward to Congress, there is not much that can be done to stop them. There is a mechanism that Congress has available to it called a joint resolution of disapproval. And this is the only mechanism available to Congress, really, on an expedited basis to try and prevent arms sales from going forward. It is done typically or most effectively in the Senate, where any senator can introduce a joint resolution to try and prohibit the sale from going forward, or these sales from going forward. There are several problems here. The first is that in all of the history of this process, going back to the 1970s, no joint resolution of disapproval has ever been successful in stopping any arms sale to any country. It requires a two-thirds majority in both the House and the Senate, and that has never been achieved. The other problem is that the administration has chosen to move these sales forward during a congressional recess. So Congress is not in session now, and they don't return until September. And the way that the administration and the executive branch reads the law, once 15 days have passed, 15 calendar days from today's notification, they can offer the contracts to Israel for signature, and then the case moves forward. From Congress's perspective, and the Senate parliamentarian has ruled, that no, you can still move forward with a joint resolution of disapproval, even after those 15 days, which will be when the Senate is back in session. But again, at that point, the contracts will already have been put out. And, the likelihood of a joint resolution of disapproval actually passing and blocking these sales is extraordinarily low. So I'm sorry to say that this is it. It's happening.
Are you surprised?
No, for a few reasons. First of all, it has been reported by the press for some weeks, in some cases, a couple of months, that these sales were coming. So I think the only element of surprise here was the precise day on which they landed. This is also very much in keeping with the approach the Biden administration has taken throughout the last 10 months, which is that they will expedite and provide everything that Israel asks for. Regardless of Israel's behavior on the ground, in fact, even turning a blind eye to Israel's behavior in Gaza. Just in the last few days, for example, we have seen the State Department decide that it will not apply the Leahy law to an Israeli Defense Forces unit called Netzar Yehuda, who were responsible for the killing of an American citizen in the West Bank, Omar Assad. This impunity and this culture of impunity that the U.S. has not only encouraged within the Israeli Defense Forces, but it's a mantle that the State Department and the Blinken State Department have taken on for themselves, that they all proceed with impunity. It is, I think, reckless. It also flies in the face of Secretary Blinken's own commitments to the international rules-based order. It is also a finger in the eye to U.S. law, the fact that we are not applying our own laws. And yet, sadly, after 10 months, none of that is surprising.
So tell us why you resigned from your position, but also tell us, please, what your position consisted of.
Surely. So I worked in the State Department in something called the Bureau of Political Military Affairs, which is the part of the U.S. government that is responsible, amongst other things, for arms sales and security assistance, weapons transfers, essentially, to partners around the world. That is a global portfolio. The U.S. is by far the world's leading exporter of arms, to the tune of about 41% of the global market, and growing, I should add. And so in that capacity, I had, as have many others who work in the State Department and work very hard in good faith, raised concerns about human rights on a number of issues in a number of countries over the course of my work there, which lasted over a decade. I always tried to raise these issues in a constructive fashion and, felt that I was able to mitigate some of the worst outcomes that were possible of some of our arms transfers, not only in the context of Israel, but of course the U.S. has relations with other countries with dubious human rights record and provides arms to them. But I'd also, certainly kept a close eye on, some of these Israel issues, having worked in the West Bank for the U.S. and U.K. governments in 2008 to 2009 and witnessed on the ground with my own eyes the impacts of the occupation, the growth of settlements, the daily humiliations that Palestinians are subject to in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem, the securitization of the region and this sort of continuous overwatch and presence that Israel conducts that makes a lot of civilian life in the West Bank very, very difficult and certainly shuts down the economy there. So this was certainly something I was attuned to. And had been raising concerns about for a while. So after October 7th, when it became immediately very clear, and I say immediately because within 24 hours, not only had Israel's bombardment begun in earnest, but of course within 24 hours, there are also these now infamous statements from Israeli Minister of Defense Gallant and from the Israeli President Herzog that, there are no innocent civilians and the whole nation is to blame and so forth. So it was very clear very quickly to me that what we were looking at was going to be of a significant scope and scale beyond anything we had seen before, because, of course, we have seen repeated clashes between Israel and Hamas in which thousands of Palestinians have been killed over the last 20 years, 15 years. It was also very clear very quickly to me that the US government was not going to lift a finger to try and pull this back, to try and walk Israel back from the brink, to try and impose any sort of restraints that, frankly, were not only in the interest of Palestinian humanity, but probably were also in the interest of Israel's own security. If you look at its positioning in the region now, the damage it has done to its own prospects for peace and security, I would argue that we failed not only Israel, not only rather the Palestinians and ourselves, but we failed Israel as well in that moment. So first of all, I resigned when it became clear that this was the path we were on. And then second, when it became clear that there was, absolutely no space for any discussion or debate. And that's what has really set this apart for me. And I think for many of us across America, is that, on any foreign policy issue in the State Department, there's always discussion, there's always debate, there's always consideration of what are the other options? Is this the best one? Are there things we can do to mitigate any harm we may cause? In this instance, the directions were coming from the top of the State Department, from the White House. Let's move forward as quickly as we can with everything Israel wants. And we see the results today. And so faced with the scope and scale of the destruction and also with the inability to move the needle at all, I think that this is an important discussion for the American people to be having. This is our tax dollars that are paying for these weapons, paying for this devastation. That discussion couldn't be had within the government. So I felt that bringing outside the government, bringing it to the American public was the right thing to do. And to do that, I had to resign.
Was there a particular moment or event that happened that made you say, this is it, I can't do this anymore?
It was the accumulation of facts over the course of those first 10 days of the conflict. And, I wrote my resignation statement, but I wrote it over the course of several nights, sitting there, watching what was happening, drafting, coming back the next day, redrafting, and hoping as well that there was going to be something that we would do to change the course here. President Biden went out in those very first 10 days to Israel and met with Prime Minister Netanyahu, and I was hopeful that, an important and effective part of his message would be a change of course, a change of tactics, a change of strategy. Instead, he offered Prime Minister Netanyahu, as he continues to, a full embrace, and that is an embrace, I fear, that has pulled America down with it rather than uplifting the other side. So, there was not one single event. It was just an accumulation and the clear indication from everywhere around me in government that there was no change that was able to be considered.
So this is a very large question, but it's one that you have major insight into. What makes the U.S. do what it does vis-a-vis Israel? Why is the U.S. such an unwavering friend, as it likes to say? Why do they like to brag about there being no daylight between itself and the Israeli government?
Yeah, so I think it's a confluence of factors, right? And I think it's important to point out that this hasn't always been the case, that this current U.S.-Israel relationship in this form really only dates back to the 1970s, that, Israel did not start off as a critical American ally. In fact, President Truman was skeptical of recognizing the state of Israel when that first occurred. Israel fought both its War of Independence and its 1967 war, the Six-Day War, in which it captured the West Bank, Gaza, and at that time the Sinai as well, with French and British weapons, not with American weapons. It was only 1973, in the context of the Cold War, that actually it wasn't even Nixon, it was Kissinger who came to Nixon and urged him to support Israel, which America did. And it was only continuing in that context in the 1970s that, Congress really began to express its full-throated support for Israel. Characterized by something called the law on Israel's qualitative military edge, which, you know, I think it's not something a lot of Americans are familiar with, but it's actually written into U.S. law that we must consider Israel's qualitative military edge and its ability to defeat any adversary or combination of adversaries when we are thinking about arms transfers to any other country in the Middle East. So that is really a function of the Cold War. I think the Cold War is also important, or at least the post-Cold War moment, right, in that for 30 years, we've also had this moment of American hegemony where we can do dumb things around the world, and the price we pay is really only the price we are willing to bear without, you know, significant geostrategic costs. I think we're coming out of that moment, and we see that our support for Israel, our unquestioning, unfettered, unconditional support, does now have costs, and I think that will shift American policy over the years to come. But I think we've been in this moment now where there has been a combination of, you know, this moment of hegemony, the absence of costs, and at the same time, this significant role in American politics of, you know, different organizations that have been promoting and pushing, I wouldn't even say a pro-Israel view, I would say a pro-Likud or a pro, you know, the most right-wing elements of Israel perspective, and that have been, you know, very effective in how they engage in our political system. And I think there are also, you know, important cultural and other ties between our countries. And of course, there are finally also growing economic ties, particularly in the tech sector. So I think it's a confluence of all of those issues. I don't think the situation is as desperate as it seems now or as hopeless. I think that change will come to the US-Israel relationship. Change comes to every international relationship. We are now, I think, at a low point in terms of what that relationship looks like from a human rights perspective. But I don't think it is going to be like this forever. I think pushing together, we can change it, and it will change.
So you also were part of a very inspiring a joint statement that was called Joint Statement of U.S. Government Officials Who Have Resigned Over U.S. Policy Towards Gaza, Palestine, and Israel, and it was titled Service in Dissent. Can you talk about that and what happened with that?
Yeah, sure. So this was a joint statement. There are at this point 12 of us who have publicly resigned from the Biden administration over this administration's policies towards Israel, Palestine. And that is, you know, as people have reached out to me, historians actually, and said that they've never seen a group like that. And I think that tells you a lot about, where this administration is going wrong, because this group of resignees represents not just the State Department. There are several of us from state, but there are also uniformed military officials who have resigned, both officers and NCO. There are folks from the there's someone from the White House. There are people from the Interior Department, the Department of Education. So it's really across government. And just to be clear, there are 12 of us who have resigned publicly, but there are dozens more at least who have left their jobs without issuing a public statement, but have just said, I do not want to be complicit in this. This is not why I was in government. In any event, the 12 of us, you know, have been in touch since each of us resigned. And, you know, it's really become something of a family. And we've been talking about, well, you know, we each have our own platform. What can we do with our shared platform to speak really to three audiences? The first audience is the Biden administration and its leadership to try and push them in the right direction. The second is the American public. And in our statement, we explain the different pieces of the puzzle that each of us saw from where we were sitting in government at the time we left. That, you know, when you put together, I think, paints a cohesive picture of where the Biden administration has been going wrong. And finally, the statement was directed to, you know, the many thousands of colleagues still in government, and particularly in the national security branches of government, who are trying to push back, who are struggling with what the government is doing, and are trying to nudge this administration towards a better set of policies, a more humane approach. And so we wanted to reach out to those folks in particular to give them our support and our encouragement, and to let them know that, we are with them 100%.
Right. You, in December, spoke out on Christiane Amanpour's show about a story about a credible case of rape that a Palestinian accused Israeli soldiers of perpetuating. I'm just going to show this clip, and then I'm going to ask you something about it.
I was part of the human rights vetting process for arms going to Israel, and a charity called Defense of Children International Palestine drew our attention at the State Department to the sexual assault, actually the rape, of a 13-year-old boy that occurred in an Israeli prison in the Moscovia in Jerusalem. We examined these allegations. We believed they were credible. We put them to Israel, to the government of Israel. And you know what happened the next day? The IDF went into the DCIP offices and removed all their computers and declared them a terrorist entity. I think it is vital that atrocities not happen to anyone, not sexual not sexual violations, not any kind of gross violation of human rights.
So I think this was the first time that something like that was said on cable television. Did you get pushback from that?
I don't know what you mean by pushback.
Smeared attack? Did people complain? Did people?
I mean, look. I mean, people are always complaining on social media, right? And I don't, you know, right. I try not to pay too much attention to that. But I think it was important to raise that issue because, in part, right? I mean, look, sexual violence was, you know, being, you know, well, of course, sexual violence is weaponized, but you know what I mean. It was being used by the government of Israel as a means of continuing to press its case and to justify right. its actions in Gaza. And I think it was important to note that sexual violence has been committed and continues to be committed, frankly, by both sides, and that we must not, we cannot turn a blind eye to the atrocity that is sexual violence whenever it is committed. And I think we've seen some very disturbing reporting of the systematization of sexual violence through the Israeli detention center in Sde Teiman, that is certainly concomitant with, you know, what Defense of Children International Palestine described happened in the Moscovia prison, and which I should know, since I, you know, you asked me about the reaction I got, you know, since that clip, I've had people reach out to me directly and say, you know, thank you so much for saying that. When I was in Israeli detention, you know, 20, 30 years ago, this happened to people I was with, or this happened to me as well. You know, I get the feeling that some of these people are sharing their stories for the very first time. It's incredibly moving. It's also incredibly heartbreaking, and it should not happen. And it needs to be brought into the light, and it needs to be stopped.
And can you tell us more about that case? To the extent that you can, obviously.
Sure. I mean, the case itself, you can go to the website of Defense of Children International Palestine and read it. You know, their case file is out there on their website. As I say, this was a boy who was brought into Israeli custody in the Moscovia Detention Center in Israel, in Jerusalem. And while there, was sexually assaulted, was penetrated by an inanimate object, and, you know, then reported this to their parents upon their release from custody. The name is not included in the DCIP, you know, report for obvious reasons. So this was an allegation that disturbed us greatly in the State Department, at least at the, you know, levels that I was working at, who were reviewing. There is a process in the State Department. I should point out it is a unique process that only exists for Israel. So for most other countries, you know, the law says you cannot provide U.S. military assistance to a foreign forces unit that is credibly alleged to be involved in a gross violation of human rights. And for every other country, before we provide the assistance, we vet the units to make sure that they are not credibly alleged in gross violations of human rights. For Israel, there is a different process where we provide the assistance first, and then we keep an ear out for allegations. And so there is something in the State Department, a body called the Israel Lehi Vetting Forum. And so I happen to sit on that forum, both because of my role in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs, and also because at the time I was helping the Human Rights Bureau strengthen their review of arms transfers. And this was one of several cases that came to our attention that the forum said, yes, does look like a credible allegation of a gross violation of human rights. Unfortunately, in the Israel Lehi Vetting Forum, in addition to the, you know, provide first and review second approach, another difference is that the next step in that process, again, uniquely, is that any potentially credible allegations are put to the government of Israel. So we ask them, hey, have you heard of this? Do you think it's credible? Are you doing anything about it? Again, that's not a step in the process for any other country. And that was essentially the problem here, that we were ready to move forward and therefore had to put it to the government of Israel under that process. And as I say, the day after we put it to the government of Israel, they went in and they shut down the offices and confiscated all the computers of DCIP. And I think that, you know, certainly shook the confidence of a lot of people in the State Department in the process. Unfortunately, it didn't lead to any change to date. As far as I know, that file remains sitting in limbo in the Israel Lehi vetting forum and has not gone up to Secretary Blinken. And even if it had gone up to Secretary Blinken, as we just saw with his decision on Netzar Yehuda on Friday, it is unlikely that this administration would take any action to actually say that an Israeli security force unit cannot receive U.S. assistance, which is absurd.
Right. I mean, I know that the Israeli government and much of the media, the Western media, repeated these claims of mass sexual violence committed by Hamas. And the evidence for that was, I would say, very lacking. And then we see that there is overwhelming evidence of sexual assault committed by Israel, and that barely gets mentioned in the press. And certainly there are no politicians talking about it. I think maybe Rashida Tlaib probably did. She's pretty exceptional on this. But, there's a recent report from B'Tselem, which is the Israeli human rights organization. Let me just find this one. I just want to called Welcome to Hell. And this, again, is an Israeli human rights organization. And it says that there is acts of torture, sexual abuse, rape, and murder are occurring on a systemic level within Israeli prisons. And they call it, they called Israeli prisons torture camps. And we have also an extremely terrible story about these soldiers being accused of sexual abuse. And I'm just going to play this video from Israeli news channel I-24, because it has so much information in it. And I think it's important to note that this is not from a network that's at all critical of Israel. So let's just take a look at this.
Protesters yelling shame and disrupting a hearing in the Israeli Supreme Court on Wednesday about the future of the controversial Sde Tayman military facility, where Palestinian detainees have been held throughout the war in Gaza, and where repeated allegations of soldiers abusing detainees have made headlines both in and outside Israel.
The matter is a matter of the laws of war. Even in times of war, it is strictly forbidden according to international law and according to Israeli law to abuse detainees. The laws of war are intended for exactly this, to prevent a situation in which enemy subjects who are in custody are harmed.
The detention facility was opened shortly after the war in Gaza began, meant to hold Hamas detainees until they could be transferred to prisons. According to the state prosecutor, the facility is of key importance.
This place must continue to operate. We are at war. It is a vital security interest of the State of Israel.
On Tuesday night, Israeli Channel 12 aired security footage from the facility showing a group of reserve soldiers picking out one detainee out of many lying on the ground, taking him to a corner, gathering around him, and covering themselves with shields from the camera. The reporter, Guy Peleg, says that shortly after the incident, the detainee is taken, bleeding, to hospital with injuries described as complex, and that the medical conclusion is unequivocal, injuries caused by the insertion of an object. Late last month, 9 Israeli soldiers were arrested for the alleged rape of a Palestinian detainee at Sde Tayman, causing protests and riots from Israeli nationalists, with backing from Israeli National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, who all say that at a time of war, the country must gather around and protect the soldiers. At one point, up to 700 people were held at Sde Tayman, but hundreds of Palestinian detainees have been transferred out of the facility in the last months.
Today, 28 prisoners are held in Sde Tayman. The laws, instructions, and regulations established by the Minister of Defense determine a series of conditions that must be met in the detention facility. The question at the center of this meeting is whether these instructions are implemented now in the Sde Tayman detention facility.
The Israeli military says it is investigating the case, which has caused uproar in Israeli society. Earlier this week, a report released by Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem says dozens of Palestinians held in Israeli prisons and detention centers since the war began describe incidents of violence, torture, starvation, and sexual abuse.
The jail was very, very tough, as you can see in my situation. It is an unfair detention, and there is killing, and they torture us with metal sticks. We were subject to all kinds of torture.
The report stated that the majority of the 55 prisoners interviewed for the report were released without an indictment.
So that's from I-24. I mean, it's stunning. It's so disturbing. The fact that they then videotape themselves engaging in what seems like with a sexual assault. I mean, is that in a military that is like, it's so beyond.
Yeah.
To me, it just seems like this impunity is, there's no potential reform of this. It's totally irredeemable, in my opinion.
I mean, no, I think that's right. I think that, you know, what we see here is very much in keeping with what we've seen in the TikTok videos from IDF soldiers in Gaza, which is just a complete dehumanization of the Palestinian people. In fact, we saw that today. I think it was Haaretz that has a report today about a Palestinian detainee who was being used, being put in front of an Israeli unit that was involved in munitions clearance and bomb clearance. And they put him out there so that if anything detonated, he would be killed rather than them. And when asked why, they said, because our lives are more important than his. And I think that's what a lot of this boils down to. There is a sense of dehumanization within the of the Palestinian people across, unfortunately, I'm sorry to say, significant segments of Israeli society, including its security forces. And at the same time, a sense of superiority that allows any sort of action, whether it is, you know, the mocking of people whose houses have been destroyed, you know, going into, you know, girls' bedrooms and holding up their underwear, whether it is this sort of sexual assault and demeaning treatment that we see in State Heman, whether it is torture, you know, when you don't think that the quote-unquote enemy, and let's be clear, we're talking about, for the vast majority of them, innocent civilians here, is an equal human being, this is the behavior that results. And I think addressing that is not simply a question of reasserting unit discipline. It is a question that will require a wholesale reconsideration within Israeli society of the Palestinian humanity and of their own humanity.
Yeah, and it's just shocking also that this hasn't been getting news coverage in the United States and the Western media. I mean, Israel's covering it because it is just so astonishing and so newsworthy. There's obviously, the media here is clearly making the decision to not cover this.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, a lot of clear double standards in our media coverage, right? And that comes out, I think, most clearly when you flip it around and say, well, if this was being done by the other side, would this be getting media attention? And of course, the answer is yes. And of course, the answer is yes when you think about civilian harm and civilian casualties and the destruction of civilian homes, the bombing of hospitals, the killing of doctors, of journalists, you know, all of these things. If the roles were reversed, there would be wall-to-wall press coverage here. So I'm sorry to say that the dehumanization of Palestinian lives isn't simply contained to, you know, the Israeli Defense Forces and Israeli society, but is very active in our own society as well. And it's something that we need to take a good, hard look at ourselves in the mirror for.
Yeah, there's actually another video I want to show, which is, I mean, still shocking. It's hard to be shocked anymore after this. But here's a conversation in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, precisely about whether or not what was done to one of these detainees who was, I guess, penetrated with sticks. So, I'm sorry, I should say legitimate trigger warning, not sarcastic trigger warning, but he was penetrated with objects, with sticks, and they actually discussed whether or not that was legitimate in the Knesset. So let's take a look at this.
להמשיך כרגיל.
להכניס מקל לרקטום של בן אדם, זה לגיטימי?
כן, אם הוא נוח והכל לגיטימי לעשות לו.
אוקיי.
הכל.
או מצוין.
הכל.
זה מה שרציתי.
הכל, האנשים האלה, אתה יודע מה עשו?
אוקיי.
So he's irate about the fact that people are upset about the rape. He's not irate about the rape.
Right.
And then when asked if that sexual violence is legitimate, he doesn't grapple with it. He says, yes, it is.
So, I mean, let me just take this back to where we started the conversation, right? Which is that, again, today the United States announced or informed Congress that we're moving ahead with over $20 billion worth of arms transfers to a security force that is in this state with a government that is in this state. I just don't understand how, you know, certainly on a moral basis, but even in accordance with our own laws, which, for example, say that we cannot provide arms to a country that has a continuous pattern of violations of human rights. You know, if there is a country where not only has there been, you know, repeated massacres on the ground, repeated killings of civilians, repeated attacks on civilian infrastructure like water, like hospitals, you know, the cutting off of food to the point of starvation, and, you know, government officials agitating for rape in prisons and the permissibility of anything, the notion that we can go ahead with major arms sales into that environment is, to my mind, unthinkable. And, you know, really, I think, you know, makes us question the judgment and the connection, frankly, to reality of some of the senior foreign policy leadership in this country right now.
Right. Yeah. Well, speaking of the actual, the incredible impunity and moral complicity, and I would say blood, people's, you know, how much blood is on the hands of our government. Mm-hmm. Let's play this clip. And this is Prem Thakur asking a question of the State Department's Patel Vedant.
The U.S. issued certain statements mourning the loss of life from some of these killings. And you talk about deterrence. Just hours ago, two twins who were newborn were killed in Gaza with their mother and grandmother as their father went to collect their birth certificates. They're 4 days old, born into war, experienced only war, killed by war. How is the U.S. responding to this instance, given, again, this comes a day after the U.S. celebrated
this? So I'm not going to speak to specific instances and incidents that happen. I will let the IDF speak to any operations they can take. I will say, just hearing this from your reporting, this is obviously incredibly heartbreaking. Again, Israel has every moral and strategic imperative to minimize civilian loss, but I don't have any of the other contours surrounding this this operation, and I will let the IDF speak to that.
Finally, just one, just on a case that you do have contours for. It's now 197 days since Hinder Job was killed, her family members were killed, the medics said they were killed. What's the update on that?
I don't have any updates for you. Go ahead.
Thank you. I have a question.
So he asked about Hinder Job at the end. He's been Prem Thakur keeps asking that question, which is so important. But yeah, so...
No, I mean, first of all, God bless the State Department press call, right? Because there are some incredible reporters there who are pressing, you know, Matt Miller and, you know, every single day. And, you know, so they are doing an incredible job trying to hold these people's feet to the fire. But, you know, what we see time and time again is people just, you know, brushing it off, as Vedant did just there. And, you know, I mean, it's been 197 days, as Prem said, since Hind Rajab's killing. That was the subject, by the way, of an incredibly powerful Al Jazeera documentary, whose name I'm trying to remember.
The Night That Won't End.
Thank you.
Yeah, we had them on, the director.
Yeah, I mean, there is massive forensic evidence of exactly what happened to that six-year-old girl in the car with her family. Who, you know, watched her family being gunned down around her and eventually died at the same time that the ambulance that was on its way to save her, who had been given permission to go by the government of Israel, was bombed and the ambulance crew just killed by the government of Israel. So incredibly distressing story, but not one about which the facts are very much in doubt. You can go back further, right? Shirin Abu Akleh, the Palestinian-American journalist for Al Jazeera, who was killed in Jenin. In an incident that the Israeli government repeatedly pointed to the Palestinians and said that this wasn't us, and then ultimately actually it came out that yes, it was. And yet, you know, no significant action has been taken against the soldiers involved in that. And the State Department's position continues to be, well, we're waiting for the government of Israel to investigate themselves. You know, part of the problem here is that the State Department and the U.S. government have a, you know, this continuing line that Israel has a functioning, you know, military justice system. We trust them to investigate themselves, and there is nothing to back that up. In fact, my experience is that not only is the Israeli military justice system incapable of investigating itself, but Israeli intelligence, when it comes across the transom in the connection with, you know, civilian harm incidents, is frequently inaccurate and intentionally misleading. And there are others as well who can testify to that, including Colin Powell's former chief of staff, Larry Wilkerson, who has said Israel lies, and it lies at every opportunity it has when it comes to this sort of thing. At the same time, right, there's an intent here. The U.S. does not want to see Israel coming before the International Criminal Court. I think increasingly a part of that is protecting ourselves from our own complicity, because if Israel has been committing war crimes, they've been doing it with our weapons that we've been authorizing in full consciousness of what is happening. But the International Court is a court of last resort, the International Criminal Court. It can only function after, you know, there has been no effort in the country where the incidents have happened to apply the course of justice. And so by saying that Israel has a functioning military justice system and a functioning accountability system, the U.S. is also sort of trying to say, well, there's no need for the International Criminal Court to be involved because, you know, Israel is going to take care of it. Unfortunately, that's blatantly not true. And, you know, time and time again, we have seen incredibly vivid and detailed examples of violations that have occurred without any sort of real consequences. So I think we do need to be very conscious of that line and of that lie, and of course of the double standard, right? And that's the final point I'll make on this, which is, you know, when Russia commits these sorts of atrocities, which they do, the State Department is rightly very quick to call them out, very quick to attack them for, you know, when a school is bombed in Ukraine, the U.S. doesn't say, well, you know, we need Russia to look into it and, you know, we're still waiting on the results of their investigation. We say, you know, this was another atrocity by Putin's forces. But when Israel does it with our weapons, and that is certainly something we have much more insight into than we do into Russian forces operations, you know, we stand by and wait for Israel to investigate itself and take no action. So again, it's that double standard at play that ultimately is, again, damaging, you know, to us, but also to the global rule of law, to international law itself. You know, when we are doing everything we can to evade the international rule of law and to undermine its functionality, that sets precedents where other countries, other abuses will happen. And people will say, well, you know, you didn't speak up in that context. Why should we listen to you now? Or why should we pay any attention whatsoever to this system, which is clearly constructed to, you know, attack others and protect yourselves? So we do an immense amount of harm at multiple levels through our continued unwillingness to recognize and act on these violations.
Just wanted to read some super chats, and one has a very good question. So Damon Ramsey, thank you for this fantastic interview with Josh Paul, an amazing man with bravery and integrity. Paul Gibby writes, Katie, thank you for all you do. More power to you. And Tanette writes, would love to hear solutions for citizens in addition to BDS. Tired of feeling so helpless. Voting third party isn't a solution and will have zero impact. Thankful for your platform.
Yeah. So I think that these can be incredibly frustrating times for all of us who, you know, are seized with, as Martin Luther King said, the fierce urgency of now. But just feel that, you know, nothing is changing. In fact, you know, that reminds me of a message I got from a former colleague of mine who is still in the U.S. government and has been, you know, trying to push things in the right direction, and wrote me a note that said, public statements go nowhere, legal arguments go nowhere, raising awareness goes nowhere, talking to our bosses goes nowhere. So I certainly, you know, understand the sense of frustration that people are feeling, both, you know, outside, and let me assure you, inside government as well. I think it's important to say, first of all, that this is going to be a marathon, not a sprint. You know, I said earlier on that I think U.S. policy will change. It's not going to happen quickly. And, you know, it certainly isn't happening in time for the people of Gaza. I think that, you know, we need to, first of all, remember that this is, you know, a huge government, and this is a very deeply political problem, right? that this looks like this is a U.S. policy problem, but actually it's a U.S. political problem. And until we fix the politics around this, we're not going to be able to make much progress on the policy. And that's true, you know, even if you had a president who was, you know, 100% on board and willing to address these issues, there's only so much they would be willing able to do within the current political and frankly, political economic constraints. So, you know, I think we do need to keep speaking up and reaching out to representatives. I also think we need, frankly, to be reaching out to media, because I think media plays a really important role here in the framing of things and or the, as you've just pointed out, not covering certain things. And just an aside on that, I was talking to a friend of mine who is an editor in a national media organization and who said to me, you know, when we say something critical of Israel, we get 100 phone calls overnight from around the public of people calling up. And each of those has to go to our ombudsman who has to address each in its own merits. And that really makes us think about how we word things. But if we say something, you know, that is biased towards the Palestinians, no one picks up the phone and calls us. So I think we also need to do a better job of, you know, being constant and, you know, hitting every single nail, every single mole, right? Every time it pops up. You know, at the same time, I think we have to engage politically. We have to take, you know, the energy and momentum that exists right now and, you know, the shift that we are seeing in American public perceptions that is, you know, certainly most marked generationally, but frankly, if you look at the polling, transcends both generations and partisan politics and turn that into political energy. And so I think that that is where we need to focus. I will say, and I don't want to get too far ahead of anything, but I'm working with some folks to hopefully launch some new projects in that space in the coming weeks. So stay tuned. But in the meantime,
we'll have to have you back.
Yeah, please. But in the meantime, I think the answer is we need to keep America's attention on this, right? Because we know that American attention can be short-lived and can jump around very quickly. So we need to keep the focus on Gaza. And we need to keep making sure that as we particularly go through this election cycle, that our politicians understand that this is an important issue to us and that, you know, this is, you know, something that we are going to take into consideration as we vote.
So two questions. What is the you mentioned a political economic system in which our politics operates.
Yeah.
So can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, for example, I've been, you know, talking to folks not only within the executive branch, but in the legislative branch as well in Congress. And I've heard from a number of different congressional offices, from staff in offices who say that we've been getting calls, you know, on a 10-to-1 ratio in favor of a permanent and lasting ceasefire. But, you know, our chief of staff won't tell our member of Congress that that's what his constituents are telling them because they don't want to create a situation where, you know, they're going to have to create a tension with a donor. I've also heard directly as far back as last December from elected officials, from, you know, someone in the House of Representatives, from a senator, that, you know, yes, you know, behind closed doors, yes, what Israel is doing with our weapons is war crimes. But I'm never going to say that publicly because, you know, it would just be a disaster with my donations and with, you know, my, you know, a lot of my sort of closest supporters. And so when I talk about the political economy, I mean that we have to find a way to shift that incentive structure. You know, it's my sense that there are actually a lot of members of Congress who do get this, who may not have come out for a ceasefire, who may not have voted you know, for a ceasefire, or, you know, may have voted for, you know, expediting arms to Israel, or whatever it might be, but who privately, you know, understand the facts and understand where justice lies. And so I think a lot of what we have to do is not necessarily convincing people, although we have to do that too, but rather shifting the Overton window and shifting the incentive structure whereby people can actually do what they know to be right. Obviously, that's also a very sad commentary on the quality of leadership that we have in Congress in many cases, you know, with some rare but important exceptions. But that's what I mean, that what we need to look at is not just the politics, but the political economy that is driving those politics as well.
Right. I mean, look at what happened to Jamal Bowman and Cori Bush.
Mm-hmm.
ruined by AIPAC, which sends such a chilling message to other politicians.
Yeah, I think
why would anyone speak out on this?
To be fair, I think we shouldn't overstate AIPAC's role here. I think both candidates who have been wonderful on this issue and really outspoken, really supportive of Palestinian humanity and of, frankly, of what is in America's interests, both also faced challenges that were very unrelated to this issue within their own specific contexts. Both were at risk. And I think, AIPAC loves to jump in with a lot of money and, then take credit for, right, something happening. And I'm not sure that it actually deserves the full amount of credit here. I think that, both candidates were in jeopardy without AIPAC's money, and we shouldn't let ourselves be daunted or deterred by that money. And not least in part, right, because there are a number of things on our side that are not on theirs, which are the facts, justice, and increasingly American public understanding.
Right. Sadly, though, facts and justice don't buy votes.
They don't buy votes, but they do, weigh into people's votes. And at the end of the day, no one is actually buying votes, right? They're buying media time. They're shaping opinions. But when you walk into that ballot box, or that when you check that ballot box or that ballot, it is ultimately each individual's ability to choose what they want to vote for. And as we have seen in elections, most recently in France, for example, people I think are capable of weighing the rights and wrongs, and so there is an important aspect of that. So yes. Absolutely, there is a very troubling role of not just money, but also really well-organized organizations and engagement in American politics. And of course, that isn't limited to this issue. It's the same with big oil, big tobacco, you name it. But I'd like to think that there is more to the American voter than money can buy.
And speaking of the American voter and elections, what predictions do you have about the presidential election? Would a President Kamala Harris be different from Joe Biden? Would a President Donald Trump be different from Joe Biden? Or would President Donald Trump be different from Kamala Harris?
I'm not going to sort of predict winners or losers. I do think that we are in a very different space now than we were a few weeks ago, when, it was Trump against Biden. I think Biden dropping out has changed the dynamics significantly, and probably significantly in the Democrats' favor, by all indications. And I do think that that should require a rethinking of tactics on our side, because, whereas prior to that terrible debate, I think Gaza was a make or break issue for President Biden and could very well have cost him the presidency. I'm not sure that's still the case with Harris. And therefore, we need to rethink where our leverage is and how we use it. When it comes down to the policy differences, I don't want to be predictive. I think, as I said before, that no American president is going to be able to turn on a dime when it comes to Israel-Palestine, even if they wanted to. And so I think we should be very cautious and limited in our expectations. I think U.S. military and financial support for Israel is not going to change within the next presidency. So I think, in terms of what we expect and what we ask for, we need to be circumspect. We should certainly, push maximalist requests and demands, because this is what justice demands. It's also what the American interest demands. But in terms of how much anyone would deviate from where we are now, I think that'll be limited. But where I think there would be a significant difference is on the domestic front. I think if we want to change American policy towards Israel-Palestine, that is something that starts at home. It starts at the ballot box. It starts in the bureaucracy. It starts on college campuses. It starts in the streets. It starts with people raising their voices. And I do think that a President Trump would be much more difficult to have that sort of public debate under than a President Harris has been. Not only obviously have I and a dozen others resigned, but I've also stood outside the White House with current U.S. government staff as they held up banners that said, you know, President Biden, your staff demands a ceasefire. Under President Trump, I'm not sure they could get away with that. You know, when we see the student protests, yes, they have been dealt with absolutely abysmally. The Department of Education has been completely absent in its responsibility to stand up for students and to stand up for, you know, all its responsibilities under Title IX. And college administrators have been, you know, hand in glove with, you know, both the police and with, you know, a lot of their trustees who've been pushing to crack down. But I think it would be a lot more violent and a lot worse and a lot more arrests, as we know from the Black Lives Matter protests under President Trump. So that's where I think the difference is. Not so much, hopefully, in the foreign policy, I don't know, but certainly in our ability to have the debate at home that enables or drives change in foreign policy.
Interesting. Well, Josh, thank you so much for joining, and please do come back. And so honored to talk to you, and excited about the work you're doing.
Thank you very much indeed for having me. I really appreciate it. And thank you for all the great conversations that you've been having on this platform. It's great.
Thank you. Okay, have a great night.
Bye.
Bye. Okay, that was amazing. What an inspiring person, so brave. And we didn't even get into this, but you know, it's not easy just leaving your job, especially in this country where it's linked to healthcare. And so really grateful. Guys, if you're watching, what do I mean? You're obviously watching. Guys who are watching, guys, give it a like if you haven't already. It helps bring more eyes to the channel, to the interviews. And these are really important interviews. And we are bringing on another great guest. And this woman is also challenging the system. In particular, she's challenging Debbie Wasserman Schultz. She is running against Debbie Wasserman Schultz in Florida. She is a former Zionist and challenging an extremely Zionist congresswoman and extremely corrupt congresswoman, Jen Perelman.
Hi, how are you, Katie?
Good, you?
Good. I was really enjoying your interview. He was awesome.
Yeah, he's great. So yeah. Brave. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah.
So tell us about your race right now. What's the latest? And then we'll talk more about Zionism, Cori Bush, AIPAC, all that stuff. But tell us where you are in your race.
Okay, so my primary is a week from today. So right now, early voting is happening. So every day we're still out canvassing. The biggest priority has been our ground game, knocking doors, getting people to polls. But that's, I believe, what every good campaign comes down to is the ground game. When I ran in 20, and it was just, we didn't have paid canvassers because we didn't have anything. Like, so we didn't have any money. So it was just volunteers. We hit such a small amount of doors. I have now surpassed that by four times in a much shorter period of time. So like our ground game is amazing. Like they're machines, our canvassers. So that's been really good. And, you know, I think that just in general, we've had a lot more visibility and plus four more years of people being that much more dissatisfied with the incumbent.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like there's this sort of like an attrition rate, plus a lot of her people die off.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah. So what made you, just for people who don't know about you and your story, and we're actually going to play a really cool video that you released, but what made you want to run against Debbie Wasserman Schultz?
I never really wanted to run against Debbie Wasserman Schultz, which is interesting. And I never really wanted to, and I still don't want to, you know, be in Congress. That's not like my career ambition. It's not a goal. I was asked back in 2019 from some people in our progressive caucus down here. And we did pretty well. We got close to 30% in the pandemic and raised, you know, let me say $400,000. And that was really not knowing anything about what we were doing, just based on obviously dissatisfaction, as well as just, you know, just wanting to do service. Which is, that's the whole premise of what I'm doing, is transforming politics into service. So I didn't want to run in 22, even though we did well in 20, just because our district was getting reshifted from the census. So I waited, and it's a good time. I feel like it could be a perfect storm. She's been sitting there for over 20 years. She takes so much corporate money. You know, all the same things that I was fighting for in 2020, that I've been fighting for since Bernie for years, we're still not having those. So I thought this could be, you know, an opportunity for a perfect storm.
Yeah. Well, according to the AIPAC tracker, Debbie Wasserman Schultz has received up to $921,255 from AIPAC throughout her career. Is AIPAC getting involved in this race?
No, and that's what's so fascinating. There's a lot of different variables because I actually started thinking about this back in 22, like strategizing and if I'm going to run again, how am I going to handle the Israel issue? Because even long before October 7th, I knew that if I ran again, there was going to be my issue. I have an Israel issue that I would call it as far as like candidate viability in Jewish South Florida, right? Like, how was I going to handle that? So I've been paying attention to this for quite some time. And I just sort of went on the offensive with it in the first place and just started my whole own Deconstructing Zionism series, just sort of, you know, really proactively baiting AIPAC. And this was in October of 22. Yeah, you were.
Yeah, I did one of those.
Yeah. So this is something I went on the offense with, knowing that that's like, okay, then I'm at least controlling the narrative. Nobody's going to dig something up and be like, oh, Jen's not for Israel. People are like, yeah, there was a whole series on it. Right. So it wouldn't be a thing. But you would think they'd care about keeping somebody like me out. And I think they must. I mean, they must be concerned. But the problem is that Debbie doesn't want any attention drawn to this race, never has. Her whole strategy is pretending that nothing is happening. She doesn't acknowledge that there's a primary.
Right.
And so she doesn't want any attention drawn to this race because she knows that she's not likable. For all I know, AIPAC realizes that too. I mean, they can probably read the numbers, you know. Right. I mean, she's not likable. So at the end of the day, they know that if they bring attention to this race, that that could work against them. And the difference is that the other races where they're really getting involved was them trying to unseat incumbents. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, they could be underestimating what we're doing. I don't know. I have no idea. But they haven't started with me.
Interesting. Well, let's take a look at this video that you put out, which speaks to how unapologetic you are about your Israel position.
This is me at 16 years old in Israel on a high school trip holding an assault rifle. And this is the definition of indoctrination. I grew up in North Miami Beach. I grew up in a very insulated, very Jewish community. We were taught that Palestine and Palestinians, that's not a real thing, that that was made up by Arabs. Everybody over there that wasn't Jewish was just Arabs. But the message was always clear that Jews were not safe and that the Arabs wanted to hurt us. My relatives, my great-grandmother, my grandmother were raised with this fear mentality that without the state of Israel, Jews around the world will not be safe. True history was kept from us. We were propagandized. But as I grew older, I began to see a different reality unfolding. I witnessed the rise of the Israeli lobby, exerting its influence on our politics and policies. I learned about the injustices happening thousands of miles away in the name of Jewish people. And I can't stay silent in the face of such injustice. The right to return denied to so many Palestinians. The war fueled by the Israeli government and sanctioned by our own country, condemned by the UN and the International Court of Justice as genocide. We cannot turn a blind eye to this injustice any longer. To me, atonement is really taking accountability for your participation in something that you now realize was not correct in some way and wronged people in some way. I participated in an ethnic cleansing state. I do not feel powerless. I feel hopeful. It is time for us to use our voices to stand in solidarity with the oppressed, to demand accountability from our leaders. As a candidate, as a mother, as an ally, I pledge to fight for justice and equity for everyone, here at home and abroad. For there can be no peace without true justice. I'm Jen Perlman. I'm running for Congress, Florida's 25th district.
So great, great ad. Love the photos. And, you know, we've talked about this before, but I think it's worth revisiting. Do you remember a moment where you started to really question the narrative?
You know, it wasn't one thing, but it was in the early 2000s. And part of the problem with this is that I also had my first child was born in 2000, my second in 2006. So the whole time is such like a brain blur to me, just in general, based on what was going on in my life. And that's when it was going on. And I was just realizing it was around the time I was seeing stuff from the second intifada. I was hearing about the anti-BDS legislation. So I started investigating BDS and just looking into what was that. And just those things where I started to realize, okay, we're not the good guys. But it really wasn't until in 2020 even where I realized that the entire two-state solution was just never even meant to be real. Like the whole thing was just a sham, you know? So it was sort of a process.
Like Gideon Levy, I bring this up all the time, but it's so smart. He says that everyone who's now for the two-state solution was against it when it was viable.
Yeah. Well, it was never real. It was always put out there as just a Zionist talking point to somehow justify their land theft.
Yeah. You know, someone wrote this, a comment I want to respond to. Victims, victims, victims. They've always been the aggressors. So in Israel, yes, but not, I mean, I think what makes this it's not complicated. It just makes it a story that requires some explanation. Because when like a settler colonial society is obviously a settler colonial society. With Israel, they have this amazing get out of jail free card, which is that they did face a lot of anti-Semitism. They were victims, but they're not victims in Israel.
No, not only that, but that was the only place where they were ever safe and they felt safe and they were actually like protected. And their Muslim and Christian, Arabic, you know, all the other peoples there were their friends. Right. And so no, they were safe there.
Right. Until they turned it into a Jewish
state. Exactly. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know if you heard this discussion that I had with Josh Paul about AIPAC, but what are your thoughts on the role of AIPAC in the defeats of Cori Bush and Jamal Bowman?
You know, it's upsetting because we're watching just how disgustingly bought everything is and how easy it just seems like it's for sale. Which on one hand, I'm glad that we're seeing on God, people are seeing it because it's been the case for a long time. So now it's just so, you know, blatant. But it is, it's unfortunate. But then I also agreed with something that he said, your guest said, was that there are other variables. There are other variables. And AIPAC needs to be registered as a foreign agent. This should not be happening at all. I mean, the whole thing is just, you know, absurd to me. But like, for example, I don't know as much about Corey's district. I know that Jamal was redistricted. And that redistricting also did affect his demographics. Also, and I say this all the time to people when they ask me about other races, I never know what other people's ground games look like. And that's what people don't understand. It isn't just about the social media and what you see. It's about the ground game. And you just never know. That's the truth. And I don't know. I don't know what their ground game looked like and how many doors they knocked. So, yeah. Right. But no, it's a disaster with AIPAC.
Why aren't they? You're a lawyer by trade, right? Why can you explain why they're not registered as a foreign lobbying entity?
Yeah, I mean, well, the justification is, or the technicality is that it's American money, it's American funded, so it's from American accounts, American people, and it's on to help Americans based on what they, you know, their relationship with Israel. It's their support of our relationship with it. This is the technicality. And basically, because it's supported by American citizens and funded by American citizens. So if it was funded from foreign money, then like they would.
Israel actually doing it, paying for it.
Is Israel doing that?
No, I'm saying if it were Israel really providing the money, because to be fair, it is really American Jews who are doing it. I mean, there's a Christian Zionist thing, and then you have the Jewish Zionist thing, which is obviously, but
yeah, no, and it's international and the evangelicals and all of that. Like it's definitely a worldwide thing.
They have their own.
Yeah, they definitely fund
Christians United for Israel.
But technically, when they have to file their papers, their money is coming from here.
Right.
So they get away with it, even though what they're doing now has been contradicted in terms of what's in the best interest of our country by so many experts that I can't eat. I mean, you've had a ton of people on your show. I know I've had people on my show about this. So what they're doing is against American interests. So I'd love to bring up this issue again. The other part about it, though, is the only other person or the only president that ever really challenged AIPAC was JFK.
Right. But it was called something else then, but yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right.
And but in terms of trying to force them to register as foreign agent. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So that didn't work out too well.
Right. For JFK. Yeah. 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 Brad is texting me very satisfied because he brought that up the other day.
What?
The JFK and the Israel.
Oh. It's true, though. I mean, it's true. And and the history runs deep. I mean, have you read Mearsheimer's book?
The Lobby? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So like that was the, you know, the first like big kind of book I read on that covered that and then I started digging deeper. But yeah, that's just very, very deep tentacles.
Right. Yeah. Oh, you can't say that word. It's anti-Semitic. Remember what? When Greta Thunberg got into trouble? Because she had like a plushy octopus in a photo.
He said so tentacle? Funny. How is tentacle?
No, she had a plushy. She had a plushy octopus.
But what does that have to do with anti-Semitic?
They say it's a trope.
In my 53 years of life, I have never heard of anything having to do with octopus or tentacle as a trope for Jewish people.
Yeah. I'm just telling you. So you're, I want
okay,
to,
well, okay, I now want
to make you aware. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, it was the American Zionist Council.
That's right.
And it was founded in 1949, and it represented 9 nationwide Zionist organizations. And it was founded as a tax-exempt umbrella organization of American Jewish groups, which focused on Israel and included the Zionist Organization of America, Hadassah, and other Zionist organizations. And in 1962, Robert F. Kennedy, the United States Attorney General, forced AZC to register as a foreign agent. In doing so, they were barred from making monetary contributions to U.S. officials, but continued to send out newsletters and hold events with a nonprofit tax exemption. In 1966, AZC was devolved after regulatory changes revoked tax exemption for foreign agents. Its former subsidiary, AIPAC, continues to operate. So what are your thoughts, by the way, on the squad?
You know, other than I've always hated the whole term, the squad. I've always sort of denounced the whole concept of a squad. I think that, again, I don't know everybody's individual districts. I know Corey and Jamal, them I've met, so I can say I know them personally. And they were very nice. So, I mean, that's basically it. As far as have they better represented their district, I don't really know the answer to that. You know, were they, I don't know. I know that they've done a lot of things I've agreed with. I know they've done things I haven't agreed with, but it's just so hard to play Monday morning quarterback with stuff like that.
And no, I just mean the squad in general, like not just Corey Bush or Jamal Bowman who were defeated, just in general. AOC, Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar.
Yeah, no, I love Ayanna that. I think that when I was watching Rashida sitting there by herself during the Netanyahu speech, I just felt so enraged. Like I cannot, I was just so enraged. And I honestly kept thinking if I were in there, I would be torn between sitting there next to her in solidarity, but then being concerned that I'd end up getting arrested. And that would be the level of rage that I felt just sitting there and watching that. So I have mad respect for her and I always have. And I've actually met Ilhan a couple of times and she's like this like ninja princess. I can't even explain it. Like she is mighty and powerful and just, and like graceful at the same time. So I have mad respect for them. You know, I'm hoping, I haven't looked. Have you seen if Ilhan has won her race?
No.
That's going to be coming up soon. Yeah. I don't know. I'm hopeful. Like that was a concern. I know Rashida is fairly safe in her seat.
Yeah. And what about the presidential elections? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I saw somebody ask in the chat if I was supporting Kamala. Yeah, no, I am not supporting Kamala. I won't support anybody that's okay with genocide. I just won't. It's funny. I always said I would never be a single issue voter. But then again, I never thought that genocide would be like one of the issues I was actually contending with. So I have now become a single issue voter. And so that limits my options. I'm assuming that my best bet will be voting for Jill Stein. I don't know. I mean, I do love Dr. West. I know everybody has their opinions about everything. I am so tired of the infighting, but yeah, I won't vote for somebody that's on board with what's going on. So that's not happening.
Well, a lot of people are saying, that she's a lot better than Biden. Let's take a look at this video of Kamala.
The climate crisis, and he intends to end the Affordable Care Act. You know what? If you want Donald Trump to win, then say that.
Sorry, I should explain. These are pro-Palestine people who are interrupting her speech. Okay.
I've seen this.
Yeah. No, but for people in the audience.
Oh, okay. Right. Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, Brad. Can you read?
Climate crisis, and he intends to end the Affordable Care Act. You know what? If you want Donald Trump to win, then say that. Otherwise, I'm speaking.
What does that even mean? What does that mean? We're not going back. What does that mean?
I don't know. Maybe like we're not going to go back to make America great, or
I have so many things about that clip that bother me. Like there's so many layers to the things that bother me. But first and foremost, I want to tell you, like, to me, at that moment when she was sitting there with that stare, I swear to you, I was waiting for Scooby and Shaggy and the team to run up, rip off the Kamala mask, and it's Hillary. That is, like, to me, that's how I picture Kamala, is it's just Hillary in a Kamala suit. Total condescension, total disrespect, total, like, just disgustingness. And, you know, not at any amount of, no amount of real humility at all. But I think she's very vapid.
Yeah, I mean, it's just funny that she overtly says the thing that we on the left kind of mock liberals for saying, which is the butt Trump.
Exactly.
Like, really? That's your response to people raising their issue with genocide? Well, okay, you're helping Trump.
Yeah. The only people that it really works for, which is so interesting, and I've talked about this before, it's, you know, I spend an inordinate amount of time knocking on doors and dialing for dollars. So I talk to a lot of different voters, and predominantly Democrat voters. So the people that in theory are her, should be her people. And without a question, the only people that are really concerned about Trump are privileged white people. That's just who it is. So when that is the message that the Democrats are going to lean into, they need to understand that that's really only reaching very comfortable people. Because people that are struggling to live, Trump does not make their top 10 list of things they're concerned about.
Right. Also, it's worth noting that Brad just texted me. Brad, you've put these in the comments, but worth noting she shushed pro-Palestine people in Michigan.
She just did that? From Michigan. Yeah. She's not, it's like they really can't read a room. And that's what's fascinating to me. I also find it interesting, and I've thought this for some time, I have always found it odd that she's a litigator because she can't think on her feet.
Yeah.
She can't, you know, everything is scripted. Every thought is a talking point. She's just like a word salad. She, you know, and I've been wondering for a long time, how has she ever been a litigator? Like, how has that worked? And then I watched the Judge Joe Brown thing and I'm like, oh, okay. Now that makes more sense to me.
What?
You got to just watch the whole video of what Judge Joe Brown puts out. I actually watched other people reviewing it, but just stuff that he was saying about, you know, that it wasn't based on merit. It wasn't based on skill in terms of litigation and just different stuff from the legal background of, you know, the hierarchy of where she came up from in the state attorney's office.
Got it.
But yeah, I always thought it was interesting. Like, how is this a litigator?
Yeah.
And then I also say, but then they want to lean into the fact that she's a prosecutor. Well, you know what? I don't want that. I don't want a prosecutor as president. I don't like that. So as somebody who's been like a defense attorney, I can say like that's not the people that I want in that position.
Right. Well, we have another video of Kamala where she's kind of changed her tune. Let's see.
Just say this on topic of what I think I'm hearing over there. Let me just speak to that for a moment, and then I'm going to get back to the business at hand. So let me say, I have been clear. Now is the time to get a ceasefire deal and get the hostage deal done. Now is the time. And the president and I are working around the clock every day to get that ceasefire deal done and bring the hostages home. So I respect your voices, but we are here to now talk about this race in 2024.
Well, if they've been working around the clock on getting a ceasefire, they are very inept.
Well, yeah. And plus, I don't believe a word that comes out of her mouth.
Yeah, of course not. But that's, I'm saying, if we're supposed to accept what she's saying.
No, I don't accept platitude sandwich. Thank you. No, thank you. Yeah, I don't believe any of that. I think that that's ridiculous. I think she was still extremely condescending in the way that she said that. And then we'll get back to the business at hand. There's a genocide happening.
She just tried a different. Yeah, she just tried a different tack.
Right. Because, again, I really feel like she's just a vapid shell for whatever Clinton Foundation slush fund. I don't know.
She may be less of a committed Zionist ideologue.
She might be, but I don't know that that makes the situation better. That just makes other people be definitively more in charge. So how does that, you know, and by the way, and this is something that, and again, I am not a Trump supporter. I am not, like, I don't like him. I've never liked him. But when I think about it, like, from like reality, we have to decide, would we be really better off? Are we better off with 4 more years of Trump or potentially 8 more years of Clintonism? And I don't know. And I'm just posing that as, I think, the bigger picture to look at. And again, I am not a Trump supporter. I personally won't support anybody that's in with the genocide. So, but I just think that's something people don't realize. And it's very much like a Band-Aid situation to some extent. Like, we're not going to get away with having to deal with the hard things. We're not going to get away with having to be uncomfortable. And I think that's what really bothers me, is that people just need to accept, people, it's going to be uncomfortable. This is going to be uncomfortable. Change is uncomfortable. You know, got to hold hands.
Well, last question from me. Tell us the differences between you and Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and also what people can do who want to support this race.
Okay. So the biggest difference between me and Debbie is that she's very corporate bought. So she's very entrenched corporate special interests, everything from military industrial complex, fossil fuel industry, payday lenders, every nefarious kind of donor you can think of, almost a million from AIPAC. So the biggest thing is that I'm just a grassroots person funded by regular people, representing regular people. And I'm also fighting for things such as single-payer healthcare, which Debbie's voted against 3 times. You know, things like, I actually think people should have a living wage. I don't believe that that our Congress people should be able to be profiting off of war, you know, certain things. But at the end of the day, she's just, you know, a corporate tool. And I don't know how much difference I would ever be able to make policy-wise or legislatively. I'm very clear on that. I don't think that the Democrats are going to, like, would not welcome me with open arms, even though I'm running as one. I have no delusions. But the idea of having that platform for 2 years, forget, like, just the idea of having that platform and being able to do the things that you could do. And I just think that that would be amazing. That would be, you know, and for someone like me, it's not supposed to be a career, and it's definitely not meant to be a lucrative career. And so I'm just seeing it as a term of service, and it's an offering. I put it out there as it's an offering for people. And, you know, look, I'm obviously, you know, I realize how this works. Incumbents usually win. So I'm infinitely more prepared to lose than to win. My election is next week, but I will say this, before we started our ground game, I was polling in the low 40s. And we have now hit, we will have hit over 50,000 doors when this is done, which is unbelievable. Because in 20, when I ran, We maybe hit 13,000 doors, maybe hit 13,000 doors. And I got close to 30%. And so now we've hit 50,000 plus doors. And I just, you know, it's very viable, but I have to be, you know, it's still reality is you got to get, make sure people vote. And so that's what we're working on. And that's what we need help with is getting people out to vote. And the best way to do that is for people to help us make calls. And it's sort of like if everybody makes a few calls, it helps us get out all of our voters down here. It's calling voters that have their ballots. And so if people can help, please go to gen2024.org and sign up to help us. And it's, you know, that's really what we need right now. Well, that and obviously money is always helpful.
Jen, hold on. We should have put this in earlier.
Gen2024.org.
Yeah. There, I just added that.
Yeah.
All right, great. Well, any final words?
No, thank you so much for having me on. I mean, it's every time I talk about it, it's just so enraging, like hearing about when we talk about what's going on and it feels very helpless, you know, like all these people, you have all these people stepping down from the State Department and yet nothing is happening and all these people protesting and nothing is happening. But I do think that things are happening. And I do think that we will see the shift. And just the fact that I was inspired just by the fact that Josh, that was his name, right? Josh, that he was on CNN.
Yeah.
And was able, that they allowed that on CNN. I felt like, okay, that's some amount of progress right there. But so, yeah, I don't want people to feel discouraged. I think that they're still, you know, I feel hopeful. And I think that regardless of whether I win or lose, you know, there's still a lot of good stuff that we can be doing and we need to, you know. Yeah, that is, it's always helpful. It is. We're a small dollar donor. Yeah. Thank you guys so much. Yeah, I'm just a regular person just trying to unseat a corporate monolith.
You may want to respond to this. I'd love to donate to the Gen campaign, but I'm a bit leery of ActBlue.
So we have a link on my webpage. If you scroll all the way to the bottom of my webpage, there's a link for if you want to donate around ActBlue. We also take, I think it's a Stripe thing. It's something else. We do. Yeah. We have something else that we'd have. And then you can always, there also is an address there for checks.
Great.
But yeah, I totally respect the no ActBluers. I'm with you.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much, Jen. Best of luck.
Thanks guys. Bye.
Bye. All righty. So this has been a great show. I'm so glad to be back. I mean, I loved doing these interviews. Brad and I had a great time. Can't wait to show you guys some footage from our trip. Again, we were working on this documentary about Holocaust survivors critical of Israel speaking out against the genocide in Gaza. And these people are really inspiring and it's really important to get their voices. Guys, remember, please support the show, patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Halper Show. If you join or if you're a member, you get a really cool like 25-minute video of Danny Morrison, who is a former Republican prisoner, giving me a tour of West Belfast. And of course, you get extended interviews and early releases. And what else? I want to just thank Brad Bloom for everything. I want to thank Andrew and Charlotte for doing clips while Tyler's away. I want to thank Phantom Asfanto for the great clips that he does during the show. And also Nathan Newburn for the research. So I will see you guys next week and subscribe, like, and become Patreon supporters. Is that it, Brad? Anything else I have to say? That's it? All right, great. See you guys next week. Oh, and future guests are include Dennis Kucinich. Okay, bye everyone.
Craving the coffee flavor you love, but without the caffeine? Cachava's got you covered with their newest coffee flavor. This all-in-one nutrition shake delivers bold, authentic flavor crafted from premium decaffeinated Brazilian beans with 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. Treat yourself to the flavor and nutrition your body craves. Go to cachava.com and use code NEWS. New customers get 15% off their first order. That's KACHAVA.com, code NEWS.